The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we've got a special show for you. We've got a guest who is from the community, who's from a faculty member in the Department of Speech Communication at the university, Stephen John Hartnett, who has been here for 6 years on campus, and he's one of the university's 2003-2004 Helen Corley Pettit Scholars of Liberal Arts and Sciences. What's that?
It's an award they give for each year's tenure class.
Yeah, congratulations.
Well, thanks, Bob.
That's quite an honor. And also, you are the author of numerous books, including Incarceration Nation, Investigative Prison Poems of Hope and Terror, Democratic Dissent, and the Cultural Fictions of Antebellum America. And I'll just go on to the bottom of the list of the most recent book, which is coming out next year, written with Laura Stengram, a graduate student in the Department of Speech Communication. And this book is called Globalization and Empire, Free Markets, the U.S. Invasion of Iraq and the Twilight of Democracy, published by University of Alabama Press. Well, let's talk about this book, because I gather you've just put the finishing touches on it, if it's coming out in the summer of next year.
We're still rushing to get the final manuscript due.
Okay. Well, what is the book about? And give us the nutshell.
Our feeling is that there's been an explosion of literature critiquing Bush administration foreign policy on the one hand, and an explosion of literature about globalization and neoliberalism on the other. But our feeling is that no one was putting the two together. So this is our attempt to demonstrate the way U.S. foreign policy, empire, and globalization go hand in hand.
Well, that's a great, if I may say so, and I haven't read the book, obviously, but I think that really is a wonderful way to encapsulate a lot of the debate over world politics over the last decade. Because as I recall, back in the mid-90s, there was a plethora of work. It was a dominant wave of work arguing that with neoliberalism and globalization, that the nation state was withering away, that capital was taking over everything, markets were ruling, governments were losing all their power, they really didn't have any leverage over global capital, for better or for worse, depending on one's perspective about business and markets. And that traditional concerns about police states, darkness at noon, militarism are really going to be undermined by this new era of market capitalism reigning all over the world, united with liberating technologies like the internet.
Yeah, if you go back and you look at that literature, it almost feels comical now, this idea that the nation state was going to wither away under the moral leadership of the captains of commerce. And of course, we realize now that that's just foolish.
So how do you link the two together then? If they are not, in fact, opposite viewpoints, but they merge together, how do they merge together?
Well, they merge together through a couple concepts. The one driving theme of the book is what we call privatizing the empire, which is the idea that if you take the principles of neoliberalism, which are fiscal austerity, market liberalization, and financial liberalization, and if you apply those to the way the U.S. is producing weapons, hiring troops, and running its foreign policy, what you get is this idea of privatizing the empire, which is to say that the U.S. government now has 5.6 million private contractors under its pay. These are people who used to be public servants. Mm-hmm. And because of that, they would have been under the rules of checks and balances that run the government. Because they are private contractors, we cannot scrutinize what they do, how the money is spent, what kind of allocations are made. So what this is doing is it's enabling the U.S. foreign policy apparatus to privatize its actions, therefore shading them or clouding them from public scrutiny.
But, I mean, the argument would be that this is introducing efficiency into the military, which has traditionally been a very wasteful area. You know, we talk about these $500 toilet seats that they used to have and all the crony capitalism. And all these bureaucrats getting away with all sorts of stuff, but now we introduce free market competition principles to the military. Isn't this increasing the bang for the buck, quite literally?
That is exactly what the neoconservatives are arguing, is that by privatizing the empire, we make it more efficient, we introduce technological innovations.
More so bang for the buck.
More bang for the buck. Yeah. The reality is, in fact, what we get is more crony capitalism. We get absolutely stunning cost overruns. We get incredible fraud and corruption. We get the privatization of cheating and fraud.
Now, is this going on in Iraq now, or is this something we can look forward to down the road?
It's going on in Iraq now, but I would say that we have to look at the situation in Iraq right now as a laboratory for where the entire U.S. government will be in 25 years.
I mean, not just the military, but the entirety of the government?
The whole government. We're looking at the division, as it were, of what used to be democratic functions, so that as you've written about, the press is now all embedded. So the free press is withering away. The IRS now can barely collect taxes from these companies because they're all shading and cheating in so many ways. The military operations no longer receive congressional oversight because they're all handled under what are called SAPs, structural adjustment programs. And that's a term that the Washington Consensus neoliberals use to talk about economics, but it's also a term that government insiders use to talk about what we would call black programs. These are programs that simply have no congressional oversight. There's 185 of these programs on the books. It's been estimated that they cost us as taxpayers $35 billion a year, and yet no one can study the budgets, no one can study why they're being used. So the entire process, the entire assumption that we as citizens have representation in our government is just completely farcical.
We're talking to Steve and John Hartnett today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We taped this show 2 days before Thanksgiving because I was going to be out of town on Sunday. So don't try to call in today. Just sit back, relax, and listen to Professor Hartnett and myself do the chatting today. Stephen Hartnett is the author of many books, including the new book we're talking about, which he co-authored with Laura Stengram, Globalization and Empire, Free Markets, the U.S. Invasion of Iraq, and the Twilight of Democracy. This book is published by University of Alabama Press and will be released in the summer of 2005. So we've got trouble in River City. We've got a military that was once an entirely public sector process in the United States, now is being largely privatized functions of it. And this is a pattern you see is going to be extended eventually to really the entirety of government activities.
And a lot of that is actually already in place. And a lot of it, we should add, that a lot of this did not begin with the Bush administration. That's why, again, the idea of talking about globalization, neoliberalism, and empire have mm-hmm. to go together, because these things go back to the Reagan administration, supported by the Clinton administration. So, for example, one of the executive orders that President Reagan passed mm-hmm. Was an order that cut off the availability of Freedom of Information Act requests to private contractors. Now, as your listeners, I'm sure, know, one of the ways that we as investigative journalists and scholars learn about what the government does is we file Freedom of Information petitions. What Reagan did is he passed this new executive order, meaning any contractor doing overseas work for the government can deny response to a Freedom of Information petition. So, for example, we've now got hundreds of these multinational corporations rebuilding Iraq, rebuilding Afghanistan. If you or I were to petition the government to get information about what they're doing, we would be denied that information under this Reagan order.
So let me just put this in language I can understand. Let's say the United States government is doing something in Iraq or some other country militarily that its military is doing. We would have a right as citizens to have some knowledge of that since we're paying for it. And it's a U.S. government activity, depending on the nature of the operation, but some rights towards that information concerning U.S. government activities. But if they do the exact same thing but give it as a contract to, say, Halliburton to do it instead or some other private contractor, we have less rights, even though our money is actually paying for it.
That's exactly right. And that's why the reconstruction of Iraq should really be terrifying anyone who loves democracy, because what we're seeing is the parsing away of our democratic rights. We're seeing all of our once public rights, our public goods, privatized in the form of these companies. What scholars of this process call them is PMFs, private military firms. And you mentioned Halliburton, Bechtel's a big one, Vanella's a big one. I could go on listing, there's hundreds of these companies.
How much money is in this private military firm industry? I mean, how lucrative is this, Rob?
Oh, Bob, it's absolutely stunning. Since 9/11, people are referring now to what they also call a homeland security complex. And those expenditures a year are estimated at $100 billion.
So that's for domestic. Homeland, $100 billion in government contracts going to private firms basically almost entirely.
Right. And that's domestic.
So this is basically the whole jobs being farmed out domestically in this Homeland Security. It's all private firms being contracted to do all the work.
That's exactly right. And what makes this even more scary is that a lot of the firms domestically are also the firms that are getting the foreign contracts. So, for example, Northrop Grumman, which is the largest weapons manufacturer in the world, one of the largest recipients of money for work in Iraq and Afghanistan, has also just signed a multi-billion-dollar deal to run the personnel system for the Homeland Security Agency. So we're seeing this interlacing of the foreign policy and the domestic policy via these private military firms.
We're talking to Stephen Hartnett today, Associate Professor of Speech Communication on Media Matters. Again, this is a pre-recorded show. We taped it a few days ago. So please don't try to call in. Just sit back and listen. Stephen is the co-author with Laura Stengram of the new book, Globalization and Empire, Free Markets, the U.S. Invasion of Iraq and the Twilight of Democracy. And what we're talking about on the show so far today is one of the most extraordinary developments, I think, that we're going to be having in this country, which is the privatization of government processes. In particular, what we're talking about is the privatization of the military activities of the U.S. government in Iraq and globally, and the enormous amount of money involved in the war on terror in doing this. And Steve, if I can ask you about this, one other thing. The war in Iraq, which is really the central issue in the United States and world politics today, the U.S. Invasion, occupation, reconstruction, whatever term one wants to use, the U.S. is basically running Iraq right now or trying to run Iraq. Many reasons have been given for it, and we've talked about a lot of them here on Media Matters over the past 2 years. Before the war started, the major arguments on behalf of the invasion by the United States were concerns about Saddam Hussein's links to al-Qaeda, to the 9/11 attacks, Saddam Hussein's possession of weapons of mass destruction, and Saddam Hussein's desire and ability to actually use these weapons in an imminent attack upon the United States. And in combination, all of these things were held up as justification for a U.S. Attack on Iraq and a takeover of the country. We now know that almost all of those arguments collapsed pretty quickly upon close scrutiny. And now we're told that the reason why the U.S. invaded and occupied Iraq and is installing a new government in Iraq is due to its desire to liberate Iraq from a heinous dictator. And it's concerned for improving the cause of justice, peace, and democracy in the region and in the world, and use this as an example that there will be no more dictators allowed, especially those who don't like the United States. How plausible are all these explanations for why we invaded Iraq, in your view?
One way to think about this is to look at what's called the handover of power between the U.S. and the Iraqi government. This happened on June 28th of 2004. On June 28th, 2004, the U.S. officially handed over power and disbanded the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority. Paul Bremer was the administrator of that, and Bremer then left Baghdad. Before Bremer left, he laid down 100 orders. Some scholars are calling these the edicts. And these are orders that have essentially structured the new Iraqi government to fit the Washington consensus model. We know that Alawi, the prime minister, CIA agent, 30-year exile, hand-chosen by the U.S. We know that all the ministries have been stocked with exiles hand-picked by the U.S. So anyone who wants to talk about Iraq being a free and independent state is simply buying Bush administration propaganda. It's just not true.
So, I mean, this gets to the reason why, you know, I guess what I'd like to get at before we go into the nature of the occupation and what's to be won there, because I think I'll answer the question is, you know, what is the reason to, you know, this is an enormous expense the U.S. government's going to. We don't know the exact figure yet because we're just in the middle of paying for it, the eventual cost, but certainly it's going to run into the hundreds of billions of dollars in resources, not to mention human life, not to mention all sorts of other costs. Ecological and political down the road. All the reasons that have been given publicly are laughable. I mean, they simply don't hold up to much scrutiny at all, or if they, at best, they are a rhetorical value to guide some people, but clearly not enough to justify an invasion of this magnitude. What are some real reasons? Why? I mean, assuming the people who are doing this are not irrational and lunatics, but actually are driven by some sort of concrete vision of how this invasion improves, does something positive in their view of the world. What explains this invasion?
Well, I think there are competing arguments about what would be that. There's the kind of dogmatic left response to say that it's simply about monopolizing the oil fields. I do think that's a part of it, but I think that's probably the least important part of it. I think a more plausible...
So you think if Iraq had no oil underneath it, this invasion still could have taken place?
That's up for debate. But the point is that we don't domestically
But that wasn't sufficient to justify the debate.
Yeah. Right, because we could have done that to any other number of countries. There's dozens of countries that have oil reserves that we could have invaded that are equally weak, equally ripe for invasion. So oil, while a factor, would not be a determining factor.
Yeah.
I think the determining factor is that you've got to go back and look at the kind of history of the neoconservative faction in Washington, most of them members of this thing called the Project for a New American Century. Most of them former employees of the Reagan administration and the first Bush administration. This is a handful of maybe 15 or 20 guys with Defense Department experience, intelligence experience, all of whom felt like we botched the first Gulf War. And they've been walking around for 15 years thinking we should have finished Hussein off when we could. If people want to see this, they can go to the website, PNAC.org, the Project for a New American Century, and you'll find their reports, letters, memorials, memos, all calling from the day the first Gulf War ended, calling for the reinvasion of Iraq.
Now, who are some of the big figures in this group that our listeners might recognize their names?
Everyone will know the names of Wolfowitz, Pearl, Feith, Rumsfeld, Rice. Crystal is a big one. Kaplan is a big one. These are the kinds of guys they write in the Atlantic Monthly. They send editorials to the Wall Street Journal. And they've been calling for the reinvasion of Iraq ever since the end of the first Gulf War.
Okay.
So I think there's a deep ideological commitment to ousting this regime that they feel we let slip off the hook. So there is, in fact, a deeply ideological component. The second component is that they in fact have the incredible arrogance and hubris to believe that they could establish what they've been calling a platform for democracy in the Middle East. There is the assumption that if we did this to Iraq, it would then democratize Iran, Syria, perhaps some of the Stan republics on the underbelly of Russia.
But, you know, when you say that about democracy, and this gets back to the common argument given now to justify the invasion. Granted, there were no weapons of mass destruction. Granted, it doesn't have anything really to do with the war on terrorism or 9/11. But we are going to set up a democracy there. But then you're saying at the same time, it seems the entire argument of your book is that by any coherent notion of democracy, what is actually being put in place there is incompatible with self-government. I mean, if you're setting up the rules of the game before there's any election, where you're sort of saying this is how the country is going to be run, now you can elect someone to oversee it, but that's basically it. What sort of democracy is that?
Well, I think you've hit on the key point, Bob, is that they happily say they're spreading democracy to the globe, but what they are spreading is what, from our perspective, looks like an anti-democratic model. The point is that that's not a contradiction within the worldview of the Washington insiders. The fact that they're privatizing public industries, spreading a prison industrial complex, denying human rights, stepping on any concept of First Amendments and civil liberties. For you and I, that seems like an assault on democracy. For the neoconservatives, that is in fact what democracy should be, a fundamentally elitist control of all civil liberties.
Now, do you think this is going to work in Iraq? I mean, here we are in November 2004, and there are elections that are now called for on January 30th, 2005. I know you don't have a crystal ball, and I'm not asking you for a concrete prediction. But given your analysis of the nature of the reconstruction, the plans that they have and the conflict they have with genuine notions of democracy, how realistic is it that 3, 4, or 5 years from now there will be an elected constitutional democratic government in Iraq run by people who basically support the U.S. position, have privatized everything, U.S. firms play an active role, there are 16 military bases or whatever the U.S. has planned in Iraq. And the people of the country are living happily ever after. Do you think that has a chance of success?
Well, I think that's the key question. It's a very complicated question. and I think the question has to be, in fact, divided into a couple subcategories. Is there a chance of success that the U.S. occupation, as now envisioned by Washington, will succeed? Yes. Is there a chance that elections will proceed on schedule with enough people participating to give it the veneer of legitimacy? Yes. Does that mean that there will be what you or I would call democracy or development in Iraq? Absolutely not. But what the Bush administration has realized is that people don't, in fact, want what you or I would call genuine democracy. They need enough goods and the spectacle of freedom to make them consent to what I'm calling the privatization of the empire.
Now, you're talking about the Iraqi people here?
Sure.
They can basically get enough of them to sign on to what they want?
I think we're seeing a
split. Well, isn't that – and then if they can do that, if a majority of the Iraqis are content with it, then that justifies the whole – I mean, then what's the complaint about?
No, and that's exactly right. And that's why the left is being made fun of in the popular press, because it appears that we are, in fact, holding up a principle that is irrelevant in the face of Iraqi support. Let me give you an example. I know that you're a great critic of the mass media, and so you know how to follow these stories. But on Monday, the front page of the New York Times had a story about another bombing, the rising insurgency, and how the country is essentially falling apart in the face of military rule. Right next to that, it had another story about the blossoming, joyous new stock exchange in downtown Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the contradiction right there. The insurgents are rising, the country's falling apart, the occupation is being shown to be a bloody occupation of the countryside, and yet there are large proportions of Iraqis who understand that they want to get on the gravy train now, they want to open up their stock market now. So what we're seeing in Iraq is the same split we have in America.
Mm-hmm. Now, you raise the issue of the media, but it seems like a logical place to go. What you're describing, how well is what you're describing understood in the United States by most Americans? What is the understanding of the average American based on what they see in the television news or in their newspaper or on a website of what's actually taking place in Iraq? And how important is the media coverage for understanding this whole process you're describing?
Right. Well, I think that's a great question, Bob. And I'll tell you, I can, a long example to illustrate the way this kind of remarkable level of deception and spectacle layers upon itself to the point where it looks like legitimacy. Let's go back to the early days of the invasion when everyone saw the images of the statue of Saddam Hussein being toppled.
Yeah, who can forget? I saw it more times than I saw Ron Artest punching out a fan last week.
And we were told that this was a spontaneous eruption of love for the U.S. troops and so forth. And of course, within days, journalists showed that this was completely staged by hired thugs from Ahmad Chalabi and a few Marine regiments.
Well, we're not supposed to talk about Chalabi anymore, so I'll let you get away with it this time.
We'll bracket him. Yeah. So this is on April 10th. The good people of Dearborn, Michigan. Dearborn, Michigan, it turns out, is home or is the middle of a region that is home to as many as 300,000 Arab Americans. It's considered the largest Arab American community in the Western Hemisphere. So on April 10th, these good Americans, good Arab American citizens, are seeing the images of Hussein's statue toppled. Mm-hmm. They immediately, in an impromptu manner, rally in the public streets of Dearborn. As many as 3,000 of them, cheering U.S. forces, singing songs to tribute of George Bush and so forth. Al Jazeera reporters are in Dearborn. Al Jazeera reporters go to cover this event and are attacked by the crowd, physically attacked by the crowd. So, flash ahead a couple days, the Washington people are sitting around and saying, well, what can we do for a propaganda stunt? And so they decide to send President Bush into Dearborn, Michigan, to give a speech celebrating the toppling of the statue. And they then set up a giant stage, and Bush gives a speech in front of thousands of cheering Arab Americans. He proceeds to give his speech, and literally, after every two or three sentences, someone in the crowd erupts with a chant, USA, 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 USA. And this then becomes a spectacle shown on all of the nightly news stations. Mm-hmm. So now, to go to answer your question, imagine someone in Nebraska, Omaha, Oklahoma. They're sitting there watching their TV. They're seeing the president giving a speech about the liberation of Iraq in front of the largest Arab American community in America. And they're all chanting for the president, USA, USA, USA. Mm-hmm. Now, odds are pretty good that you'd see that and think, well, we've done a good thing. The Arab Americans support us. Aren't we a righteous nation?
Yeah.
Now, it takes an incredible train of research to track that line of propaganda back to its original fakeness in Baghdad. The question is, do most Americans do that? Of course not. I think what they're getting is the stream of patriotism, the stream of heroism, the stream of bravado.
Yeah, but journalists are different, shouldn't they be? I mean, journalists, theoretically, should be tracking it back. They should be exposing, if it's a propaganda ploy, not actually a genuine uprising in Baghdad to overthrow the statue. They should be raising that issue.
Well, but I think you're our best critic of that. You know that most journalists simply do not do that kind of homework.
But it seems like the point I'm getting at, rather than just talk about the press coverage, is rather the importance of managing the news supply to this new world order you're describing. I mean, it seems imperative if you're going to have this privatized military and this aggressive U.S. presence around the world, it requires the domestic population to perceive it in a very different manner than it actually is.
No, that's exactly right. It requires the mass production of propaganda at every level regarding economic policy, foreign policy, military events, military appropriations. That's exactly right.
And how has this taken place in Iraq? I mean, in the reconstruction agenda, how important is this ideological framing for the U.S. population?
Oh, it's absolutely crucial. Because if American citizens understood that $100 billion a year of their tax dollars were being taken away from their public schools and away from their hospitals and away from their roads and away from their health care and funneled to private military firms building prisons in Baghdad, people would go crazy. I mean, I fundamentally believe that the American people know when they're being ripped off.
Mm-hmm.
It's simply that they don't know that yet because the press is not telling them. I think if they knew the facts of what's happening in Baghdad, we'd have an uprising on our hands. And that's why Laura and I have written the book the way we've written it. We're trying to simply publicize what is happening.
We're talking to Steve and John Hartnett today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Steve and John Hartnett is Associate Professor of Speech Communication here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and he's the author of many books, including the brand new book with his co-author, Laura Stengram, Globalization and Empire, Free Markets, the U.S. Invasion of Iraq, and the Twilight of Democracy, which will be coming out with the University of Illinois Press in the middle of 2005. We taped this show a couple of days before going on air, so please don't call in. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy it. And I hope you've all had a wonderful Thanksgiving weekend. Let me take this opportunity, if I can, to let you know, dear listeners, that if you would like to get a weekly update of who our guests are going to be, who our past guests have been, an archive of old shows, plus links if you can find out material about the books and articles that our guests have written, so you don't have to write that stuff down while you're listening to the show. All you need to do is send an email to our producer, Victor Picard, and you can do that at vpicard@uiuc.edu, vpicard@uiuc.edu. Once again, you only get one a week. You won't get any more. If you want to get off, you can get off instantly. We don't give these email addresses anywhere else. You get no spam, no junk mail. A lot of our listeners have found this a very useful way to sort of stay on top of what's going to be on the show. While I've got you here, a couple other notices. 1 week from today, our guest on the show will be Paul Krugman, the New York Times columnist and Princeton economist. And we've got a number of other really good shows lined up for you, so please stay tuned to Media Matters here on WILL AM 580. Well, this book you're writing, Stephen, it's really, I mean, you're talking about the United States. Now, we're really the big empire in the world. How does the world politics emerging out of this new neoconservative trend with the Iraq War? What are the big conflicts that are coming up internationally and domestically in the next 5, 10, 15 years?
Well, I think there's a couple ways to answer that question, Bob. One thing is that throughout the 90s, particularly in the Clinton administration, it was understood that U.S. foreign policy was linked directly to neoliberalism. So what the U.S. Department of Treasury wanted was what the IMF wanted, was what the World Trade Organization wanted, and so forth. But what we've seen in recent years is a splintering apart of the whole globalization initiative. Mm-hmm. The World Trade Organization is immersed in controversy. The attempt by the U.S. government to put forward this thing called the Free Trade Area of the Americas, it looks like that's falling apart. The IMF is under increasing pressure. So one thing that's happening is there's a global uprising against neoliberalism. People are realizing that it's a fraud. They're realizing that it produces
For
profit.
Some of our listeners who might not be familiar with the term, what we mean by neoliberalism, and I think some of our listeners aren't, this isn't a term that's used widely except on this show. What do we mean by neoliberalism? So they'll know what people are rising up against.
Neoliberalism is a term that's broadly used and broadly misunderstood. It's relatively simple. Starting with the New Deal, go back to the American Depression. It was understood that capitalism as a system is fundamentally irrational. It produces boom and bust cycles. It creates a few very rich and a ton of very poor people. It destroys the public good. This is why the New Deal was put in place, to manage capitalism, to rationalize capitalism. And so what that meant is from roughly 1930 on up to, say, the Vietnam War, what we call the public good was understood to be entrusted largely to the government. Towards the end of the Vietnam War and really picking up steam in the Reagan administration, people tried to then reverse that process and privatize all public goods. And so when people say neoliberalism, what they mean is this return to a 19th century version of a liberalism where the public good was in fact a privately held good. Mm-hmm. So neoliberalism is the attempt of the U.S. to get foreign governments to spend less of their own money so that they have to contract it out to private people. It's an attempt to open up markets so that goods can circulate freely without tariffs.
So business can run everything, basically.
That was certainly the Clinton model.
Yeah.
But the point is that that model has been shown to be utterly disastrous. You look around the world and what you see is a string of economic catastrophes.
Like where?
Well, if you look at what has happened in Mexico in the last 15 years, for example, poverty has doubled. Mm-hmm. The number of millionaires in Mexico has also doubled at the same time. What we're seeing is a production of an oligopoly in Mexico. Mm-hmm. Look at the financial crises in South Korea, in Thailand, in Indonesia. Look at what's happening in the major cities of India, where, again, we're seeing the rich taking off to a new level of wealth and then the production of massive pools, millions of poor people. If people really want to see the effects of this, they could go online to the New Left Review and see a recent essay called The Planet of Slums, which mm-hmm. describes how what we're doing is literally producing a new universe of mega slums. So what this means is that people are realizing that this whole chant of globalization and free markets doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So the first answer to your question is what we're going to see in the next 10 years is a global battle over economic development, whose vision is used, what models are employed. So that's one thing we're going to see.
Mm-hmm.
And we will see that because the demonstrators understand how to use the media, how to get themselves into the public. I think they're very sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that we're not going to see then is the same battle played out over military policy. This will involve the basing of U.S. troops all around the globe. We currently staff 825 military bases in 153 countries. Now, there's only 189 countries in the United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so think about that. 825 bases in 153 countries. It's a remarkable string of imperial power.
Yeah, I had Chalmers Johnson on the show earlier this year, the author of many of the books that talk about the U.S. bases around the world and quite critically. And I asked him, I don't know if you recall this, but I asked him, what's the second leading country for having military bases outside their own borders? Who's number two on the list? I assume we're number one. I can't imagine anyone beats us. And you know who number two on the list
is?
No, who is
it?
Every other country in the world, because no other country in the world has a single base outside its own borders. And we're the only one that plays the game.
It's amazing.
And so, you know, which is an interesting way to look at U.S. power, because most Americans really don't quite have a sense of us as this sort of military power.
Well, and Johnson has a great phrase where he calls this colonialism without colonies.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the new imperialism of military bases. Now, the thing is that these bases are remarkably unpopular almost everywhere. Cynthia Enloe has written about this. She's a wonderful scholar. And what mm-hmm. she's done is she's gone and done studies of the neighborhoods surrounding U.S. military bases. And what she finds is that U.S. military bases function essentially as toxic waste. What leaches out of them is environmental destruction, sexual predation.
Aren't they surrounded by whorehouses or brothels?
You name it. But it's more than that. So it's whorehouses, it's brothels, it's drug dealing. All of these bases are structured under what's called a Structure of Forces Agreement, SOFA.
Mm-hmm.
These SOFAs, for example, allow all U.S. military personnel in foreign countries to leave the base in U.S. vehicles without license plates. Now, you can imagine what this does to a 19-year-old kid from Arkansas who gets tanked up on a Saturday night in Okinawa mm-hmm. and is out driving around with unmarked plates. So there's an incredible number of traffic accidents, rapes, thefts. So these bases function as the producers of toxic waste. They're incredibly unpopular.
These are like safe houses.
So the question is, what's going to happen to the future of these bases, particularly when, as Johnson has argued, most of these bases serve no military function whatsoever.
And if it is a military function, it might not be one that's popular with the people in the area.
Well, it's not popular with people in the area, and all it really does is support authoritarian regimes. Look at what the U.S. is doing in Uzbekistan, for example.
Mm-hmm.
This is a famously undemocratic country where we're establishing military bases. Now,
it's also famously sitting on some of the largest oil supplies in the world, if not the largest.
Well, exactly. And this is the point of the book. So that what mm-hmm. we've got now is the U.S. military privatizing forces to these firms, sitting on these oil fields in the name of democracy. The locals don't want them there, and it doesn't help us as American citizens. It's just an incredible charade, Bob.
No, what about all the other major powers in the world? I mean, does the government of Germany or France or Japan, how do they respond to this U.S., not just invasion of Iraq, but having this military presence around the world? Is it in their interest? Are they part of this system too?
They are not only part of the system, but they're largely financing the system. And France is a great example that in the days leading up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, France was famously opposed to the mm-hmm. war, and Americans went crazy about that. In fact, I saw a bumper sticker just the other day saying, boycott France.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that the French also need the same things we need, particularly particularly access to that oil.
Yeah.
The French are only too happy to have us waste our capability to ensure them cheap oil.
So they're not opposed to the U.S. Military role or dominance of the world in any fundamental way?
What happens in France and in Germany is that the politicians find that it's politically useful to complain about U.S. unilateralism.
Mm-hmm.
It makes them look like good nationals who won't be the lapdogs to U.S. empire.
So they should be cut in on the policymaking process. They shouldn't just be barked at.
They're part of it, supposedly.
Yeah, yeah.
But the fact is that behind closed doors, they are part and parcel of the same system. They have the same interests.
And so where is the – if this system is fundamentally flawed, and I get the sense you're not a big fan of it, How does it change? Where in this process is there going to be opposition or resistance to make the system be different?
I think there's a couple of places we're seeing resistance rise up. And one of them, paradoxically, I may be the first person to ever say this on your show, but it's actually coming out of the Pentagon and the CIA itself.
Mm-hmm.
Long-term, lifetime military and intelligence experts recognize that this politicization of U.S. foreign policy is fundamentally insane.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, in fact, if you log onto the CIA webpage, you'll find some of the best critiques of the Bush administration being authored by longtime CIA agents.
And soon to be unemployed longtime CIA agents.
They may be. But the point is, like in Watergate, when the Nixon administration began to unravel from inside,
mm-hmm.
I think that's what we're probably going to see in the second Bush administration, is a slow but sure unraveling of civil servants recognizing that they are, in fact, being turned into chumps by this politicization process. So that's one place we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
People like Chalmers Johnson.
I mean,
Johnson worked for the CIA. Johnson was a longtime defense expert who now, in the twilight of his career, has suddenly come to these realizations. So I think more and more people like Johnson are going to come forward to show the insanity of the system. That's one place.
Yeah, but, you know, as you just pointed out, you've got to go to a CIA website to find this. You're not seeing a lot of this right now in the media, in the news media. Most Americans are largely oblivious or unaware of this. Assuming it's not going to jump into the front pages of the lead stories and newscasts anytime soon, where, aside from the CIA website, would you urge people to go to get a critical view and critical news and information for what's going on in the world today, a view different than that provided by U.S. news media?
Well, I think it depends on how active you want to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's say you just want to sort of get your feet a little wet to sort of get a sense of what's going on, an alternative view.
One thing you can do is that if you're a reader who can read between the lines, simply go to the horse's mouth. Everything that I've described here is not being done in a underhand, covert manner. These are things about which the Bush administration is very proud.
Mm-hmm.
You can go to the White House. You can go to the homepage of the State Department, and there's press releases describing everything that I've said to you.
Yeah, yeah.
So one thing you can do is just go to the government's own resources. It's all there. You simply have to piece it together.
Yeah.
Let's say
you don't have time to do that. I mean, let's say you've got kids and a job, and you've only got like 20 minutes at the computer, say.
If you've got 20 minutes at a computer, this is what I would do. I would log on to the CEPR, the Center for Economic and Policy Research. It's a public, non-affiliated watchdog group. They've got everything that you need to know about these subjects right there. You can download them. It's free. It's easy.
CEPR.org?
CEPR.org.
Okay.
You can log on to www.hrw.org. That's humanrightswatch.org.
Mm-hmm.
You spend 10 minutes on their webpage and you can learn anything you need to know about what this administration has done to human rights globally and domestically.
Mm-hmm.
You can go to warprofiteers.com. That's one word, warprofiteers.com. And they'll tell you anything you need to know about the contracting process and the reconstruction of Iraq. And just from those three sites, you'll get links to hundreds of other sites.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think the thing that listeners need to understand is that while free speech is slowly withering in America, and while the corporate mass media is little more than a propaganda outlet, the web is in fact full of remarkably good journalism being done by concerned citizens. And so you can spend a small amount of time on the web and get a vast amount of information.
We're talking to Steve and John Hartnett today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. This is a show we pre-recorded a couple days before Thanksgiving to air on the Sunday following Thanksgiving. So please don't try to call in today. We've got about 15 minutes left. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Stephen Hartnett is the author, along with Laura Stengram, of the new book, Globalization and Empire, Free Markets, the U.S. Invasion of Iraq and the Twilight of Democracy. Stephen, you've been a political activist as well as a scholar for many years now. Is that something that works well for you, or is there a tension there trying to be a tenure track and now tenured professor and then taking what are clearly controversial positions on social and political issues?
I don't see it as a tension. I see them as natural processes that flow together. I think that to be a good activist means you have to be informed on the subject. You have to have the facts at your command, and that's what scholarship is supposed to be about. The trick is to not let your scholarship become so esoteric that people can't make sense out of it. So it's really a translation question.
Well, it's also an issue of when you're doing your scholarship, if it's too focused on activist issues, is it taken seriously as scholarship? I mean, is that a concern you had as you tried to, you know, map your way through the thicket to get tenure?
Yeah, no, that's a What I learned very early on, and I learned at the hands of others who had done this same kind of thing, like yourself, Bob. And I was always taught that you cover your academic bases by writing the kinds of articles and the kinds of journals that one needs to do to get tenure, but you then translate that work into editorials and op-ed pieces and mm-hmm. performance pieces, and so that you try to have your cake and eat it too.
How would you characterize the state of activist scholars today in the United States as you look out? You've been in the field now for many years. Do you think it's a thriving area? Do you think it's languishing? What's your sense of activism among academics?
I think it depends on how much sleep you get the night before. It all depends on your mood. I'll give you an example.
Okay.
Last year, I belonged to an organization called the National Communication Association. It's the largest organization of communication scholars in America, about 6,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
Our annual meeting was in Miami last year. Coincidentally, at the exact same time as the ministerial meeting for the Free Trade Area of the Americas. So here's the future of the free world's economic development is being decided in downtown Miami while all the scholars are hanging out on the North Beach. So along with friends and colleagues, I tried to organize a demonstration of our professional scholarly peers to go to the political organization. And out of 6,000 conferees, we got a crowd of 12.
How many of those were grad students?
I think about 9.
About 9. That's about the percentage I would have anticipated.
So you could see that as a terribly depressing thing, or you could say, hey, the future of these graduate students, they want to do this, and it's a question of can people like you and me, can we empower them to do that work? So I think that a lot of students want to do activism. They want to engage in citizenship questions. It's just a question of can we create a space for them to do that?
A lot of your activism in the past and your work in the past for many years has dealt with prisons and the prison crisis in the United States. This is an issue that, excuse me, I've been very interested in for a long time. I wish I could have done more work on it because it's so important. Why don't you just spell out the nature of the prison crisis in the United States and how it compares to other nations and how it compares historically to what it's been in this country?
The prison crisis in America is one that it's hard to overstate because you don't want to sound hysterical. You don't want to sound conspiratorial. But the fact is that the nature of the crisis is slowly but surely eating away the soul of America. There are 2.1 million men and women in America's jails and prisons. It's an absolutely stunning number. There are 5 million men and women on parole, probation, or house arrest. If you add those two numbers together, you're looking at over 7 million Americans under direct disciplinary control of the state. And if you multiply that by 3, which is, according to consensus figures, the size of an average American household, you're looking at as many as 21 million people directly affected by the prison industrial complex. These are people whose economic livelihoods are going to be destroyed. Even if the husband goes to jail, the wife's economic future is sacrificed. If the wife goes to jail, the child's growth is sacrificed. So you destroy a family when you send someone to jail for life.
So it's 7 million out of 290 million people. What was the numbers roughly 40, 50 years ago to give some sense of comparison?
40, 50 years ago, the numbers wouldn't even have shown up. It would have been so small. This is all a phenomenon that has exploded after the Vietnam War. This is a phenomenon that coincides very clearly with the rise and success of the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement.
Oh, really? Explain that.
If you look at American history, you can go through a series of cycles. Under the system of plantation slavery, discipline was in the hands of each slave master. There weren't prisons. There weren't county jails. There was no need for them. If mm-hmm. a slave disobeyed, you simply whipped him. If he got out of control, you hung him. It was a private matter. It's not until the end of the Civil War and the end of slavery that suddenly all these southern states realize that now what are we going to do?
Mm-hmm.
And so suddenly chain gangs, plantation labor, the convict leasing program, as it's called, evolves as a kind of answer to the end of slavery.
What about up in like Vermont at that time or Pennsylvania?
Most of those states up until the end of the Civil War would have a small county jail. You might get tossed in it if you were drunk or something. It was understood at the time that discipline happened within the family and within the community.
Mm-hmm.
There would be exceptional cases, mass murderers, rapists, arsonists, and they would be hung. I mean, the death penalty was used widely throughout the North.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is that disciplining citizens and holding on citizens was not a major part of the infrastructure of the state. It was
mm-hmm.
an aberration.
Mm-hmm.
It's really not until after the Vietnam War that it becomes, in fact, an industrial complex woven into the heart of what the state does.
So how much is the prison, as a percentage or as a raw number? How much, can you give me some sense of how much it has grown from 1970 till today?
You know, I can't give you a number off the top of my head. I mean, I can tell you that the idea that we have 2 million people in prison is unprecedented. It would have been, you know, 100,000 before.
Okay, yeah. My sense is it's been an you know, exponential increase. It's not doing like a 50% or even doubling or tripling, but it's just
if you were to plot this on a graph, the arrow would be almost straight up.
And how does this compare then to other countries in the world? What other countries in the world historically have had this percentage of their population in prison or part of their prison system?
Well, this within what's called now comparative criminal studies is mm-hmm. a really, really hot subject. I mean, it really depends on how you want to define the criminal system.
Yeah.
I mean, Stalin killed 21 million Russians under labor camps and concentration camps. We're not near that.
Mm-hmm.
So what makes our system unique, right? We can find many countries that have had death camps and concentration camps.
I mean, just the way you're answering this, we're going right directly to Stalin.
Right.
We haven't even stopped to pass go. What about things like, you know, Germany or Canada or Mexico or other countries around us?
Their systems up until 10 years ago were not comparable. They understood that it was in their best interest to deter crime rather than punishing crime.
Mm-hmm.
They understood that most crime committed, particularly by young men, were crimes influenced by alcohol, and that most of these kids needed was to dry out rather than go spend 20 years in the slammer. So as recently as 10 years ago, they did not have comparable systems. Now, part of globalization is that one of the largest export industries from the U.S. are prisons, prison technology, prison weapon systems, prison mm-hmm. surveillance systems. And so what we are, in fact, slowly seeing is the spread of the U.S. prison system around the globe. This is why the scandal of Abu Ghraib in Baghdad is so crucial, not only because of the sheer horror of the images of torture, because mm-hmm. it shows us the future of globalization. What we are spreading to these developing countries are prison abuses.
Mm-hmm. But most other countries don't have anywhere near the percentage of their civilian population behind bars as we do they?
The only comparable situation would be in China.
Okay. Yeah, and that's the point I was getting at. I mean, I'm trying for our listeners' sake, most of whom know very little about this issue unless they're participating in it for reasons I want to talk about in a second. The scope of it is really mind-numbing for an ostensibly free society to have so many people who are unfree.
Well, and the fact that to explain it, I have to think about Stalinist Russia. I mean, that shows you the extent of what we're talking about.
And people don't know much about it. This isn't an issue that gets hardly a shred of coverage in our news media, is it? Yeah, you called it maybe the issue that could bring down the entire republic.
It's an issue, again, you have to think about who are those 2 million people in prison, the 5 million people on parole and probation, who are they? They are 53% white, but of them, you know, overwhelmingly poor white and rural white, about 35, 36, 37% African American, and then the rest made up of Chicanos, Native Americans, and so forth. So we're talking about a segment of our population that has almost no representation in Washington, no access to the mass media, no corporate influence. So no one needs to speak for their interests because no one benefits from their interests.
So there seem to be of little interest to the editors and reporters in our newsrooms.
Well, why would they? They're not selling advertising to them.
So why is this a threat to our republic? Can't we live on merrily just locking up people who sort of get in the way?
Well, you know, your question there echoes the question about what's happening in Iraq. The question is, can we maintain this system and save the soul of democracy? I would say no. And there's a couple of very simple reasons why. Now, I taught college in prisons for 10 years before coming to this campus. And since I've been here, I've been traveling around doing death penalty work. So I spent a lot of time with prisoners and prisoners' families. And it's not uncommon that you'll meet a 6 or 7-year-old boy whose father is in jail. His father was in jail. His father was in jail. His grandfather was a slave. I mean, what we're talking about is the slow but certain reproduction of a caste system.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about entire generations of young black men who cannot get education.
And there's really a significant racial component to this. Although 53% of the overall population is white, the proportion of African Americans in the prison sentence system, especially African American men, is significantly greater than white Americans.
They make up approximately 13% of the national population total, and 3 times that many in the prison system. So they're completely overrepresented.
But is it a case that people are getting locked up more for the same crimes that were done 30 years ago? Or is there more crime than 30 years ago? I mean, what accounts for this dramatic growth in the population?
That's one of the great paradoxes of this all. The crime rates have remained stable for the last 30 years. There is no escalation in violent crime in America. What we are seeing, in fact, is the production of new modes of criminality.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing
That sounds very professorial. What's that mean in English?
It means that in the 1840s, if I went out and you and I got tanked up and we were walking home at night drunk and I knocked over a street lamp, you might, you know, beat me up. Or my father might give me a whooping, or my neighbor might give me a whooping. But it was handled internally. It was a disciplinary problem.
Mm-hmm.
You commit that same act tonight, that's disturbing the crime. That goes on your record. You do that two more times, you're going to jail.
Mm-hmm.
25, 30 years ago, if you were caught possessing a small amount of marijuana, there were all kinds of ways to handle that short of a mandatory sentence sending you away to jail for 10 or 15 years. So what we're doing is we're taking acts that used to be frowned upon but not treated with prison and now treating them with prison. So we're multiplying the number of people who can go to jail.
Mm-hmm. And what percentage of the people in prison are there because of violent crime?
At a national level, on average, it's under 30%.
And so these 70%, I mean, aside from Martha Stewart, what are the other—
It's drugs. It's all drugs.
It's just drugs.
This is what we're talking about is we're seeing the effect of the drug war.
Okay. It's just drug, like possession of a drug.
We're seeing 15—
Of a recreational drug.
15, 16, 17-year-old kids caught with small amounts of drugs on the street getting locked up. Kids who could use counseling, maybe drug rehabilitation, sent to a community center. So any number of ways that we could productively handle them. And instead, we lock them away for 10 and 15 years. And what that means is you get a 15-year-old kid who may have been misbehaving. And when he comes out, what you've got is a hardened 35-year-old criminal.
And you get that 15-year-old kid, if they're coming from a middle class or upper middle class suburb, and they're found with a bag of pot, what are the chances they end up in the prison system?
Nil. Absolutely nil.
I mean, it's purely a class and race-based enforcement of the law.
That's right. That's right.
Well, we've only got a minute left. How are we going to solve this one, Stephen?
Well, I think we want to, again, mention to your listeners that the web is full of information. If they seek clarity on any of these issues, they can simply find it on the web. I also think that although people don't see it in the mass media, they need to know that the country is alive with activism. Every community I've been to is having marches, rallies, conferences. I mean, it's time for us to kind of get involved and take the country back.
Stephen John Hartnett, I want to thank you very much for being our guest today in Media Matters. Stephen John Hartnett's the Associate Professor of Speech Comm here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, author of many books, including the new book, which we've talked about at length today with Laura Stengram, entitled Globalization and Empire, Free Markets, the U.S. Invasion of Iraq, and the Twilight of Democracy. Stephen, again, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Bob. It's an honor.
And 1 week from today, please join me again here on Media Matters, and my guest will be Paul Krugman of the New York Times. And I want to thank Victor Picard, my wonderful producer, for the great work he's been doing. See you in 167 hours.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Classic Tan and Swimwear, Champaign; Colonial Pantry, Champaign; and Spectrum Consulting in Mattoon. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny with a high in the lower 40s and northwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of light rain and light snow after midnight, the low in the lower 30s with east winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, light rain and light snow likely, the high in the lower 40s with east winds around 10 miles per hour. This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. 580 on your AM dial and on the internet at will.uiuc.edu. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.